Do you know what this is? No, because it's too far away and you can't see it, and it's no good to have a prop that's too far away. This is what I think they call a fob. I don't know why they call it a fob. You probably do. What you'll notice about this fob is that it has buttons and it has a keychain, but it has no keys. It is for a vehicle, but it has no keys. And so it confuses me because it's meant to help a car go, but it has no keys. You haven't heard me complain about a car in a while. Fortunately, our Gonna Make You Trust Christ Acadia GMC has gone the way of all wickedness, and my gracious father-in-law here is letting us borrow a car, which I'm so thankful for and have had no troubles out of it, and it has this fob. And I've realized something about this fob. They've taken something precious from me. In this new technology, which I understand is becoming the prevalent technology, is they've taken away the connection point between this apparatus and the actual driving of the car. They've taken away the natural connections. There was a time in human history where you drove a car, and the way you initiated that process after having opened the door was you stuck a key in an ignition and you turned it. The key very obviously had something to do with the igniting of the engine and the driving of the car. And guess what happened when you were done? You never just left your keys in the ignition, the car running, and just got out and forgot your keys or left them in the ignition, because you wouldn't do that. You would have to take the key out, because the driving of the car and the cessation of driving the car, we're all connected to the putting in and the taking out of this key. But now, there are genius people who came up with this, and I don't know why, and some of you will tell me later. Now, we have this thing that makes the car go, but, for instance, you could have this thing near your car, like in your house, and you could leave. And then you would get to where you were, and then you'd want to come home, but you didn't have this thing. Your car started without it, but it won't start without it, and you don't realize you don't have it because all the clues have been taken away from you. This has not happened to me, but I know people this has happened to. I'm being serious. It hasn't happened to me. But what has happened to me in like the last 47 of the last 50 days is I regularly get to the car, and I'm like, where's that fob? And I'm looking in every pocket and like in my bag and in my pants and under seats and everywhere, because the last time I drove the car, the fob was incidental to the process. I got out of the car. I know I must have had it because I drove the car. It must be somewhere. I'm not a guy who loses things. I'm not orderly, but I'm obsessive. So I don't tend to lose things. And if I do, I can't rest until I find them. And so I spend a lot of time looking for this, because they have disconnected this apparatus that starts the car from the actual movement and actionable parts of driving the car. So that's its own problem. But it does remind me, when we think about work, which is how a lot of us spend a lot of our days, whether that's work that you're paid for or work that you're not paid for, that very easily our Christianity gets separated from our daily work. And it's not easy to see how they're connected. And so you wind up with a lot of frustration, a lot of unnecessary frustration, or a lot of frustration that could be aided. It's like having this fob that's not connected to the starting of the leaving of the car. You may not have it with you. They've taken away an obvious connection between the key and the ignition, and something has been taken away from us in a world where we've come to think of nearly everything in economic terms. We don't even realize how much that's the case, but we do. We think of almost everything in terms of how much it costs or how much we make. We think of whether something's good or bad, or whether someone is good or bad based on how much they make or how much they don't make. And so we're going to talk a little bit today as we continue this series on colonizing earth with the life of heaven. where we are thinking about being this pilot community. The church is this pilot community of people who have come under the sway of Jesus, and they're learning a new way of life. And not just learning it, but they're practicing a new way of life. They're believing different things than their neighbors about what people are, about what their neighbors are, about what work is, about what their speech is for. And the apostle in Ephesians here is giving us a few applications to a bunch of people that he started out by reminding that they used to be dead as doornails, in the sense of closed up and locked away from God, and they used to follow the ways of this world and the ruler of the kingdom of the air, the spirit who is now at work in those who are disobedient. Paul, as we'll find out over and over when we look at the Bible, believes things that we don't naturally believe. Like, following the ways of the world can be an unwitting practice of following Satan. You don't know many people who claim to be Satan worshipers, but Paul would say there's a lot of people who are under the sway and influence of this ruler of the kingdom of the air. There are all kinds of kingdoms, but the way it feels to us is like this: gratifying the cravings of our flesh and following its desires and thoughts. So that's good. People just do what they want to do. We just think about things the way we want to think about them. We just go after what feels good for us to get. And Paul said, that's deadness. That's death in life. And God has invaded you and begun to turn your curved-in self outward. So suddenly you notice God, who has a claim on you and who also makes you and satisfies you. And all of a sudden you notice your neighbor. You don't only notice yourself anymore. And you start to think about yourself as someone who exists for the good of others, who exists as a possession of God. And he keeps on. So I tell you and insist on it in the Lord, you must no longer live as the Gentiles do, as everybody else does, as the nations. In the futility of their thinking, they're darkened in their understanding, separated from the life of God. They've given themselves over to sensuality. They've lost sensitivity to God by the hardening of their hearts. And he says, but you're the pilot project of God. You're the new society of God. You're the theater upon which God is displaying a new thing. Here's what people are supposed to be. The very life of the King Jesus. And you know, Christ is not Jesus' last name, right? It's not Jesus Edward Christ the Third. Christ is a title. That's why Paul sometimes will call him Christ Jesus instead of Jesus Christ. Messiah Jesus, King Jesus, Anointed One Jesus. It's a title. And he's talking to people who have acknowledged that title. He said, there's the true human who's now the King, who's offered us redemption from ourselves and from the disfavor of God, and has started to make us people who are rightly related to the King, to each other, to the world, and to ourselves. And he gives them some examples as they're putting off this old way. You know, they're putting off Grandpa. We got Jesus in our heart, Grandpa in our bones. What is the corrupting part of us? Not just, doesn't mean everything your grandpa touches is wrong. But what are the corrupting parts of us? We're putting those away, and then we're putting on the new self, created to be like God in true righteousness and holiness. And so he starts to say, look, there's this new way of being in the world as people who are acknowledging the kingdom of God, the wise and benevolent rule of God. One of them is the way we talk. We don't use speech merely for our own advantage anymore, which means words aren't just for us to bend and spin, even if deceptively, so that we can get what we want. He says, put off falsehood and speak truthfully to your neighbors, because we're all connected. You can't introduce this infection of deceit into this body where everybody's connected. You don't want to make the whole thing sick. So we put off falsehood and we speak truthfully. Or anger. You know, Paul might say, I know, anger's fun. It's the best one. What's more delicious and scrumptious than getting really good and angry? Get angry, he says, but don't sin. Don't let your anger be a raging forest fire that devours the people around you. And therefore give the devil a foothold. There's the devil again. And then he gets to work. And he says, he who has been stealing, he's talking to thieves, he's been stealing, must steal no more, but must work, doing something useful with his own hands, that he may have something to share with those who are in need. He who has been stealing must steal no more, but must do something useful with his own hands, so that he may have something to share with those in need. Why do you go to work? Most of you here are not thieves. Why do you go to work? In the morning? Or why will you go study for a test? Or why will you clean up your house and make supper? Why will you work? The old way of thinking, which is the way of this world, is a purely economic way. It says, here's what you are. You're someone who is made to take things. And in that respect, Paul could be talking to all of us, not just thieves. See, you can be a very respectable businessman and, in a sense, a thief of the community. If you approach your work, you approach your investments, you approach your development in a completely self-consumed way, I'm here to take as much as I get and much as I want. And I'm here to protect it from everybody else without respect for anybody else. That's thievery. That's what a thief does. A thief says, I go out into the world and I need things, and so I'm going to take them. And Paul says, that's the old way. And see, what gets easily seeped into the marrow of our bones and factors into our imagination is this idea, as is mentioned in this book, The King's Economy. It's helped me a lot, and I'm thinking about a lot. This idea that what people are is they're just economic units. What a person is someone who has unlimited wants in a world where there are scarce amount of things. And so our goal is that we would work hard so that we could get as many of the things that we want and then eventually not have to work anymore. So we're going for leisure, and we're going for acquisition, and we're going for how can we get as much for ourselves as we want and as we need. How can we satisfy ourselves with our work? And Paul would say, that's an old way. That's the world's way of thinking. That isn't the King's way of thinking. And in fact, that way of thinking winds up making everybody pretty miserable. In this book, they point out the fact that as rising incomes over the last 50 years, rising incomes around the world, you know what has also risen with rising incomes? Depression and suicide. You know, lots of people say, money won't make you happy, but everybody wants to be the exception. Well, let me try. I think I'll be the one that gives it a whirl to prove the exception. John Wesley had this famous saying in one of his sermons, and it's gotten repeated lots of times. And as a Calvinist, I feel like Calvin told me in my prayers last night to deconstruct Wesley. Just kidding. But he says this thing about work. He says, you know, gain all you can, keep all you can, and give all you can. You may have heard that said before. Gain all you can, keep all you can, give all you can. It's in a sermon on money, and that's not all he says, and it's very unfortunate for people to take something out of context like I'm about to do. It's proverbial. It doesn't cover every situation, as no proverb does. But it does capture, I think, a way that we can accidentally come to think, even in Christian circles where we know that our work is supposed to produce some amount of surplus that we're going to give away. We're people who know we're supposed to give away stuff. So it's easy to think, make as much as you can, keep as much as you can, and give as much as you can. But I would argue that even that statement is inadequate. Because it makes all of work boil down to money. That what we're doing when we work is just acquiring money, which means that if you happen to have a job that isn't valued very highly in our current world, then you aren't anything, and you're kind of out of luck. There are people in here who are teachers, and I don't know, last I checked, teacher makes what, $250,000 a year? And some of you, I may be off by a zero or two, or three. Three zeros, I'm off. Do the math. Or, what if you care for an infirmed parent? Or what if you're a mom who stays at home, or a dad who stays at home? Well, then, what do you do if you don't actually create any money or earn any money? Then you aren't anything. Ha-ha! Congratulations. I think there's a whole host of people in our world who have been taught, if you don't make money, you are not anything. And that's really unfortunate, because what happens to old people who can't make any money? Well, they're not anything. Let's get rid of them. Yikes. What about the young? What about people who do service jobs where they don't get paid very much? Are they something? Do they have something to offer? One of the things I think the apostle would have the king's people start to think is, no, when you're thinking about work, one of the things you're thinking about is just a different orientation altogether. I'm not a single acquiring economic unit. That's not the primary way of thinking about myself. And so I don't approach my job each day. I don't approach the world each day to say, what may I take from it today, like a thief would. Instead, I'm thinking, how may I do something useful with my own hands? Now, this is instructive for Christians, because it is interesting, isn't it, that Paul does not say, he who's been a thief, now that you're a Christian, go evangelize the world in your work. Be that annoying guy at work who's handing out tracts all the time. Why does he not tell them that? Why does he say, do something useful? Because Paul's view of the kingship of Jesus is very huge. And it goes all the way back to the creation in the garden, where slaves were told, Hebrew slaves were told by Moses, hey, you've grown up every day of your life being told, you know who the Son of God is? Who's the image of God? Pharaoh. The one at the top of the heap. He's the ruler. He's the co-ruler with the gods. He is the image on earth of a god. You know what you are? Nothing. You're trash. You're useless. You're dispensable. Work you as hard as we want. Doesn't matter what you are. And to those very people, God says, here's how you came to life. The breath of God is in you. And you were made male and female in the image of God. You have been placed on this earth as mediators of God to the world. You're the image of God. You're his royal image. Everywhere you go, you're a reflection of the God of the heavens. And so all the things we do in the world by this delegating God, there's all manner of useful things that you do in your work. It's so exciting. Have you thought about that? That God doesn't just let little babies, he doesn't just like speak little babies out into the world and have little cadres of children just running around ruling themselves, or he doesn't just speak them into adulthood, but he puts this very laborious process whereby you don't sleep anymore. And at great cost to yourself, you invest in this little person so that they become a person. God has delegated the care of image bearers to parents. God delegates his ministry of housing and justice and beauty making and art and teaching the young and healthcare. He delegates all of these things to people called nurses and lawyers and artists and teachers. And he says, you represent me in these things and you do this useful stuff in the world on my behalf. It's important to start to think that way instead of merely thinking about money, because there's a whole lot of people in here. You're going to finish college soon. Some of you are going to go out to work. And if you only think of your job in terms of money, here's what's going to happen. You're going to get a job, and let me guarantee you how much money you're going to get. None. Not enough. It's going to be a bad amount of money. I don't know what the amount is, but it's going to be not the right amount. And you're going to say, this isn't worth this. You're going to realize how many hours a week you're there, and you're going to feel like you're getting ripped off. And if you only think of your work as a place to get money, then you're probably right. But if you think of your work as somewhere God has sent you to be useful, to do something good for your neighbor, to do something good for others, well then, who knows? Students, moms and dads, people at insurance offices processing claims, people selling things, making things. You're out there to make something useful, to be a benefit to God's world. Oh, it sets you free, I think, to think only about, from only thinking about money. I had a friend when I was working at a software company. See, I worked at a software company before it was cool. And I got exposed for the first time to people wearing bare feet to offices on casual Fridays. Their sandaled, flip-flopped feet. It's the mid-90s, right before a big tech boom and bust. I mean, in the middle of a tech boom, right before a big tech bust. And I had this friend who hated his job. I liked him very much. And I remember him saying, I figure if I can just stick with this, and he had a savings plan going, if I can just stick with this, by the time I'm 55, I'll be able to retire. And I'll be able to get out of here and live. And I remember thinking, wow, that's awfully sad. That's more years from now than we are presently. We were 25. And he had a plan that involved grinding it out for 30 years for enough money so that one day he wouldn't have to work anymore. And he would just give up more years than he already had spent, looking forward to that day. Well, he had just been discipled badly. A lot of people think like that. If I can just get enough money, then I can get enough leisure, then I can do real life, because work isn't anything. But work is something. The work you get paid for and the work you don't get paid for. Because we're representing God to do something useful in the world, to give to others, to enhance their lives, to benefit them. So you start thinking like this, and you could start to say, how may I talk about my work? Do I go, I owe, it's off to work I go? Or can I think about my work as a student, or my work as a pastor, or my work as a construction worker, a plumber, an engineer, the storyteller, whatever you happen to do, to say, I am a servant of Christ sent into these waters, into this arena. King, how do you want to broker your life through me today? What useful things will you do for others today through me? It makes a big difference, and you have to start talking about it that way. I try in our meetings, our staff meetings, because I heard a pastor one time, a long time ago, say this. And I'm trying to do it myself and think, I don't want our staff at Rock Creek Fellowship to think of ourselves as employees of the church. I want us to think of ourselves as servants of the church. That's harder, but it changes your disposition. If you think of yourself as an employee, you put yourself in a realm where you're thinking all the time, am I being paid enough for what I'm doing? Is this worth this? But servants don't ask that. Servants say, Christ, my king, has sent me here. Let me give myself for the benefit of these people. Think of yourself as a servant. You talk about yourself as a servant to yourself. You think of your work as work that's been entrusted to you, that you've been sent to do. And then he goes on, and he says, so you do something useful with your own hands instead of just taking. And you do this so that you may have something to share with those in need. The apostle envisions that the other aspect of our work is that it will be a benefit to people who are not able to work, or who don't have enough work, or who did not make enough money, or who did not get enough of what they needed. And so our plenty at times will supply for the lack of others, or the lack of others, or their plenty at times may supply for our lack. This, of course, implies that some of us are going to be in different places at different times. In the passage in Deuteronomy, this idea of sharing gets baked into the economy of Jesus' people, even when it comes to farming, where they're thinking not just of charitable giving, which I think the Bible talks about plenty, almsgiving, giving away, but it also talks about baking into the institutional economic life of a community, into small business owners who own a farm. If you are beating the olive branches for olives and they come out, don't go back through a second time. Leave some of the olives there. Leave some of the wine, some of the grapes there on the vine. Leave some of the sheaths there that you didn't glean so that people who have been left out of the economy can have work to do. So part of this idea that we work in order to do something useful, we also work in order to have something to share. Depending on your abilities, some of what we do in our work is we create opportunities so that others can work to be able to share. They left profits in the field. They did not maximize their profits. They said, we're going to leave some income-producing possibility out there in the field so that somebody else has a chance to do some work so that they can participate. God seems to like everybody to have a hand in this. Some of my most joyful things that we've done as a church over the years is when we've been able, after the tornadoes, to hire work crews of people who are out of work to let them build and repair houses that have been destroyed for others. So people who are out of work were getting paid to do work for people who are in need of repair that they couldn't pay for. And it's exciting to think about this unusual economy of God, where people are getting to pitch in. And you know the expression of the feeling, if you've had small children and been one yourself, how much you wanted to be maybe like your dad or like your mom. You wanted to pitch in, or when your little kids want to help you do something, they want to help you mow the lawn. And you're like, well, yeah, you're really strong. There you are, 3 years old. You got a good 4-inch step, so it should be quick. You're very focused. So we'll be able to go at it for a long time. Powerful, so heavy machinery is not a problem for you. And yet you let them do it. You let them share in the work, not because they're so good at it, but because you want them to have the privilege of pitching in, of learning how to work, of learning how to serve, of learning that they exist for the good of others and to do good things on God's earth because they've been placed here as the image of God, mediating his presence. If you start to think like this, you can start to think, if you're a person in charge of things, start thinking about how you pay people. I read of some company where a guy said, I started realizing what people most want in the world, says the Gallup polls, is a good job. And I realized as a business owner, one of my most valuable assets is to be able to offer people good employment. He started employment programs for people who are underemployed or outside the typical scope of things. And he says, I stopped thinking of wages as an expense, but I thought of it as part of our profit as a company. Now, that didn't sell to shareholders if you're trying to be publicly traded. But it's a new way of thinking. It's a kingdom way of thinking. It says, If I only think economically, then you know what employees are? They're a cost. That's it. They're an expense. And do you think that in your family? Oh, we got all these kids. I have six expenses if you have six kids. Well, that's not what you think, I hope. Don't think that. Don't think that. You don't think that. You have children. You don't have expenses. And if you run a business, you have people, image bearers. They're not mere expenses. And if you think in terms of being the king's representative there, then you're not merely going to think of people in economic terms. How may I bless them? How may I help them to do their lives and have something to share? And if you're a worker, to think of how may I bless the ones who hire me? How may I represent the king well in doing useful things here? This idea of sharing can make its way into all kinds of things, new ways of thinking. A few years ago, I was at a restaurant. My friend Walter said, "Watch this, watch this." He said to my friend, we're in Pittsburgh. He's going to tip him exactly 15%. Down to the penny. He'd seen me before. Somebody at some point told me 15% was the tip amount. So I did that religiously, scrupulously. But then I started thinking, well, that's just like the mechanistic rule. But over time, I started hearing like humans who worked in the restaurant industry, who happened, by the way, to be the most generous tippers. The poorest people work in restaurants, and they tip the best because they work in restaurants. They know how hard the work is and how little they get paid. And so all of a sudden, I started thinking, oh, this isn't just about this mechanism. This is about the image bearer who's doing good work. Why shouldn't we overtip them? I sometimes now pay too much for my haircut every single time. And you're like, well, yeah, you sure do. You don't even know how much I pay, though. No, but you know what? I actually get a very bargain haircut, but I've started realizing, you know, the person who cuts my hair is a single mom, and she does a really good job, but I'm imagining that she doesn't actually, she doesn't own a condo in Florida as her third home. And so, little by little, as the king's thought gets in me, I start thinking, I don't care about the convention. Let's think, how may we be generous and honor people in their work? There's all kinds of opportunities. I don't know what they are. You'll have to think of them. But that's what's exciting about the Spirit of God at work in so many of you. You're already so generous. And you go into your work and think, how may we do something useful? How may we think of this as representing the king? How may we work in such a way that we may create sharing all the way around? Who knows what might happen as you ask Jesus to work these things through you? I close with this. Yesterday, Kathy made lunch with another woman for about 35 people, most of whom were teenage boys. So this is no big deal for her because she usually feeds me. No, it was quite an undertaking. And she made a great lunch for these guys in a doubleheader baseball game, which the doubleheader means, 14 hours. And there was this, there was an umpire there after the kids had eaten. Kathy offered this umpire food. We're trying to teach people that umpires are people too. It's easy to forget. You think I'm joking, just sit at a baseball game and watch how perfectly respectable, decent people treat umpires, and you will come to believe that they don't think that umpires are real people, and they certainly weren't born at any point to a mother. But Kathy gave this guy food, and she had scooped these melon balls of watermelon. You know, this guy ate all this stuff. He came up to her afterwards. This umpire. Ma'am. He was a formal umpire. I want you to know, ma'am, that I was stationed in Afghanistan. And a child came up to me once and offered me the crumbs of his bread or the crusts of his bread or something like this. And it was the most refreshing thing I had ever had at that point. This kid shared with me his food. I was in Afghanistan. It was the most refreshing thing I'd had. And he said, and today when I ate that watermelon, it was refreshment like that. And she was like, oh, but it's just watermelon. No. But it was touching. To think of this guy who's not part of our community, he's an outsider. He's an umpire. But he had been invited in through sharing, through someone laboring to do something useful and saying, here, why don't you participate with us? And it made a guy who would normally feel, I can only imagine an umpire feels very lonely at baseball games, because I haven't been to any of them where both sides aren't phenomenally hostile towards them. But he was given this refreshment of watermelon to be a part of the thing by a generous woman. And isn't it interesting that God, when he tells the Israelites, hey, don't glean everything in your field, leave some for somebody else. He doesn't say, so that the economy can hum well and everybody can participate and we'll have a thriving economic base and the tax system will grow because we'll have more revenues to tax and everybody will be able to participate in the security of a sound system and own a home. He says, here's why you do it. Because you know what it's like to be a slave. You know what it's like to be left out. You know what it's like to be nothing. And the strong arm of God reached down and said, here, you're mine now. You know what it's like now that you're gleaning in this economy of abundance, but you also gleaned and gathered in the economy of scarcity called the desert. And in both, God was the one who provided for you. You're the people of the great King, and he has given generous things to you, and you know what it's like. So make provisions for that for other people in the way that you work, in the way you comport yourself, in the way that you share. You're the people who have been refreshed. You're not an economic unit. You're the purchased people of God, liberated from slavery, in whom God is making the fullness of Christ himself. Go out into the world, asking this Christ to refresh others through you, through watermelon, through your work, or through your words. And that you'll find a satisfying work indeed. Amen.